Hello everyone, and welcome again to the Associate Affiliate Cricket Podcast. We've got a whole bunch of tournaments to talk about, including World Cricket League Division 3, World Cricket League's European qualifier for Division 5, and some iCup and World Cricket League Championship matches with Scotland and Namibia. And to join for those is Andrew Dixon. Hi Andrew.
Hi Russ, hi everybody.
Andrew, we'll start up with World Cricket League Division 3, and it was... Our predictions weren't quite right, but we did predict at least there was going to be an interesting tournament, which it was. We might start with Canada and Oman, because if you kind of look at the trajectory of the table and even the first couple of days, Canada and Oman were pretty much the dominant teams. They both qualified, but they both had a little bit of a hiccup along the way.
Yeah, it was a bit of a sort of seesaw sort of tournament. There was times when it looked like, you know, one team was running away with it, and then they'd lose. And it was a close tournament, which is what you want from a World Cricket League tournament. You don't always get. You know, still up until probably the penultimate round of matches, there was still a case of where anybody could have got promoted. It was only sort of after that penultimate round that things started to settle into place. I think, you know, Oman, I think we did predict to be promoted again. Uganda getting relegated, I think, is a bit of a surprise, especially playing on home turf. You know, they've been bouncing between Divisions 2 and Division 3 for... well, forever, since the World Cricket League started, and now they're going down to Division 4. And then USA, you're finishing, not, you're just staying in Division 3 again, which I think will be disappointing a lot of people, not least the ICC, who are targeting them to qualify for the next World Cup. So, yeah, an interesting tournament with some interesting outcomes and some interesting consequences for what's going to happen from now on with these teams.
Yeah, so Oman, they just keep on moving forward. I think we mentioned in the last podcast that they had been at pretty high up in the past, and they've obviously sorted out whatever caused them to be dropped. It was relatively straightforward for them. They lost just the one match over Canada, but other than that, finished at 8 points clear on top, and net run rate of 1.2, so they were pretty comfortable. Canada was a little bit of a surprise. I think I said that they do better than you did, but one of the surprises was that Rizwan Chima had a really good tournament for him, which is the first time in quite some time.
Yeah, he sort of finally sort of come good. You know, he actually had two decent matches in a row, which doesn't happen very often. In fact, I don't think it's ever happened for him. You know, he's got 91 from 44 balls in first game against Uganda, and then in the game against Oman, he had a decent knock as well, scoring 42 from 25. So yeah, he had a good tournament. Perhaps, you know, he's not captain in the side anymore. Maybe that helps a bit. But, you know, he's not going to be around for much longer. I think he's in his late 30s now, and so. But then, you know, again, John Davison kept playing for Canada until he was, you know, in his mid 40s. So. You know, Canada do keep these players around for a long time. But yeah, I mean, I think the only surprises for Canada was that final day defeat to Singapore by, you know, obviously a narrow margin. But you would expect Canada to be able to chase a total like 166, and then they weren't able to there. But obviously they were still safe, net run rate rise.
Yeah, they were safe. So you wonder, it was a bit of an odd match. They also lost to Malaysia, which was even more strange because Malaysia was otherwise so... didn't win any other matches. In both of them, bowled out for 141 against Malaysia and 164 against Singapore. So there's obviously a bit of an issue with their batting when Rizwan Chima struggled, given how many runs he was scoring. There was a couple of collapses, and the collapse against Singapore, which we'll get to, because the final day was pretty exciting, but that was pretty bad.
You sort of wonder, is Rizwan Chima batting a bit too low in the batting order? He was sort of coming in at sort of 7 or 8 in most of those games. You know, do they actually need him to be a bit higher to try and get a bit of a platform for the, so that if there is a collapse, then they've got a decent sort of start and are able to still put on an okay total? But when you've got Rizwan Chima coming in, you know, down the order, he's, and there's been a collapse at the top of the order, there's only so much he can do.
Covered briefly Malaysia, I mentioned already they only won the one match. They needed to beat Oman on the last day by a really significant margin. They started that chase. They actually were in a reasonable position to keep Oman down to score in a low cup 200s, and then it got out of hand and they got to 293, which I think they needed to chase in about 35 overs, which after about four overs they were on track, and then they lost a bunch of wickets and were bowled out for 162. So disappointing tournament from Malaysia. But the other three teams were coming into the final day all in with a chance of relegation. The interesting thing was, and I prematurely tweeted that Uganda was safe at a point where, in order to be relegated, they needed Canada to fail to chase their score against Singapore and lose 6 for 86, and Uganda would have had to lost 8 for 84. And yet somehow they contrived for both of those two things to happen, which meant Singapore was safe by about 2 runs, and the USA was also safe by, in the end, I think about 9 runs, because Uganda, it didn't even need to chase the full total, and they just needed to get a few runs short of that because of the net run rate. So quite a remarkable turnaround for Uganda.
Yeah, they were sort of well on track. You know, they obviously bowled the US out for 145, and the US had a decent batting lineup. And you know, obviously Stephen Taylor, Alex Amsterdam, but you're both very good batsmen. Tim Roy Allen as well, and Elmo Hutchinson was good for some runs down the order. But to then fail to chase 145, especially after being in the position they were, you know, they were 82 for 3. And you know, 90 for 4 and 105 for 5. They just sort of collapsed. You know, the sort of last sort of wicket partnership threatened to start actually putting on some runs and getting them close. From 114 for 9, they did make 132. As you said, they only needed another few more runs and they would have been safe. And the vagaries of net run rate.
Yeah, and Singapore's victory over Canada by 2 runs kept them safe, because their net run rate was inferior to both the USA and Uganda, so they would have gone down if not for the collapse of Canada, which was a remarkable result in itself, which ended up also relegating Uganda. So it was a pretty amazing last day. One of the things that was stood out for Uganda and is with their batting, their highest score in the tournament was 217. Which is not unusual for them to have not very good high scores, but it's almost impossible for them to continue to keep playing these tournaments with them batting at the standard it is, because you can't keep scoring 200 and expect to defend it time and time again. And it was quite noticeable watching some of the highlights of Mohammad Irfan. He had a very good innings where I think he scored 100 off, or very close to 100 off, not many balls. But it was very much a slogger's innings. There doesn't seem to be a lot of discipline in the Ugandan batting lineup, and that's effectively why they got relegated, because they collapsed too easily.
Yeah, and you know, it's not as even if they can blame the conditions in this case. You know, they can't say they were unfamiliar with them. You know, they were playing at home. They're playing on pitches they would have played on a lot during their domestic careers, and you know, they should be used to batting on them, and they seemed like they were one of the visiting teams in this tournament. You know, just completely incapable of batting in those conditions, which was very surprising. We usually see the home side do very well in World Cricket League tournaments.
And the USA, to finish, they scraped through by the barest of margins as well, but it wasn't a particularly impressive tournament for them, despite the strength of their batting lineup. It never really fired at any point.
No, it didn't. Whether they're distracted by off-field things in the USA, but they were very well prepared for this. You know, they had a tour to South Africa just before it, which we've said in the past, if USA had a good preparation, then they would do well in this tournament. But unfortunately, that wasn't the case this time.
Kenda and Oman will be heading up to Division 2, which of course will be joined by the bottom four teams in the World Cricket League Championship. And another round of that's been played, or finished rather, because there was only the two games left in round 5, which was between Scotland and Namibia. The first of these matches was quite odd to follow, because it went over 2 days, and at some point it looked like it might be a Duckworth-Lewis target, but it wasn't, because it rained slightly too much and they went into the reserve day. But the upshot of all that was that Scotland won. They scored 268 in the first innings, with Barrington making 110. And Preston Momsen, whose retirement may not have actually involved any matches, was back and scored 49 at the finish. And Namibia, who had Christy Bouillon back, batted deep, but not well enough, eventually being bowled out for 217.
Zhivago Grunewald, as well as being the best-named cricketer in the world, managed to score 42 from 20 to get Namibia a bit close, but it was too little too late. Good to see Vilhoun and Momsen back for the two sides. And Namibia needed to win at least one of these games, and they did go on to win the second. But that sort of, as you say, it was quite tricky to follow. It did end up being reduced to 43 overs, but Duckworth Lewis wasn't involved. I just find it a little bit odd when they start reducing the overs when they've got a reserve day, and also due to the fact that at this time of year in Scotland, sunset isn't until getting on for 10 p.m. You could quite easily have fit this game in one day. It's always a little bit odd to see those situations, but such are the playing conditions of international cricket. They never always make sense. A good innings from Berrington as well for Scotland. He scored a century from just 90 balls. And I think Scotland after that match would have backed themselves to do well in that second game, but it wasn't to be. Namibia sort of turned it on with a bat in that second game.
No hundreds from them, but Stephen Barnes and Zane Green started them off pretty quickly, and 124 when Baird was out in the end of the 19th over, and they carried on to 324. Craig Williams also scored 69, not out at the end there. Kyle Kurtzer scored 100, Richie Berrington made 61, but Scotland, they were probably well placed, I guess, when Berrington got out at 3 for 159 at the 30th over, but it fell away after that.
I think we're looking at a bit of perhaps inexperience in chasing big totals there. It's not often you see your 300 from an associate side. So maybe something of, there's a little bit of that there. Yeah. So they did at least manage to bat out of the 50 overs, which you often see sides when they're trying to chase that sort of big target down get bowled out quite cheaply. So they did at least manage to put some runs on the board. The win keeps Namibia in it. Had they lost that game, they would have been confirmed as going down to Division 2, because they would have been unable to get into that top four. It's still a long shot for them. They need to win all four games and hope Hong Kong don't win any. Hope Hong Kong lose all four games at the left. It's a tough ask for Namibia to stay up, and for the UAE, who are also bottom on the same number of points in Namibia. So things are starting to take shape in this tournament. We don't quite know exactly what will happen, other than teams getting into the World Cup qualifier. There's talk of the 13-team ODI structure. That should hopefully be more clear after the ICC meetings next week.
Yeah, looking at the bottom, Hong Kong will be playing Nepal, and they also have to hope that Nepal wins both matches, but not so well that their net run rate goes up. So it would be very unlikely for Namibia or the UAE to get out of that bottom four, as you said. But Scotland's loss makes things a bit interesting. They would have expected to be only a point behind the Netherlands going into the last two rounds. With matches against PNG and Kenya to come, now they're a point behind PNG. They're pretty well ensconced in the top four. They need Kenya and Hong Kong to both do well to overtake them, which would mean that they'd have to lose probably both matches to Kenya in the final round. But it means it'll be much more difficult for them to get over the top of the Netherlands, who now have a two-point lead at the top.
It's tied to the Netherlands are going to be the winners of this tournament, so you never sort of quite know what happens in these events. So it's going to be interesting if it does end up being just one team into that 13-team ODI structure, and it is the top team from this tournament. We could be in for a very exciting finish, especially if they do have that sort of simultaneous final round.
Scotland and Namibia also played an Intercontinental Cup match. Unfortunately, as is occasionally the way in Scotland, it rained completely on 2 days, and the pitch seemed relatively...
Not just in Scotland. It's not just in Scotland. It seems when Scotland are playing away, it rains as well. I'm even expecting when they play Papua New Guinea for it to rain in Papua New Guinea. So.
Well, that's at least tropical. It was quite a surprise when it rained in Dubai. At any rate, this was a match where Namibia declared at 7 for 403 in their first innings, as much as anything in the hope that they could get first innings points, but more rain and a reasonable batting effort from Scotland meant that on the final day, they lost only 2 wickets to make 223, which means that for Scotland, they're now no longer able to catch either Afghanistan or Ireland because they're on 37 points. And Namibia's on the bottom with 27, so it's probably not any new news to know that Afghanistan and Ireland are fighting out this tournament, but Scotland will probably be a bit upset that a number of their matches have been rain affected.
Yeah, as we were saying, you know, you sort of expect rain in Scotland, but perhaps not elsewhere where they've been playing. So they've had a lot of bad luck. I think I saw they've only actually played maybe 5 complete days during the 5 matches they played, or something ridiculously low like that, which is just unfortunate. And you're just not going to be able to get results in those situations. It's also a shame that, you know, despite this tournament lasting three years, they can't actually have some sort of reserve matches so they can replay some of these rained off games. It's perhaps a little bit short sighted for a tournament that is, you know, increasingly important for the associates.
I guess a reserve match would be almost as much trouble as an extra reserve day and play 5 day matches rather than 4. But in this particular instance, I'm not sure even 5 days would have helped get something, maybe at first innings result. While we're talking about Scotland, though, they have had some other positive results, probably more positive than the matches against Namibia. Starting with a couple of games against Sri Lanka in the lead up to this, where they weren't official one day internationals. But Scotland managed to get a victory in the first of those by 7 wickets.
Pretty comprehensive win. Kurtzer and Cross-Kurtzer is in some form at the moment. Put on 201 for the first wicket, which is a decent opening by any yardstick. And they managed to, you know, didn't collapse after getting that great start and held on for a 7-wicket victory. So, and you know, Scotland were weren't full strength in this game. You know, they were missing probably 3 or 4 players who they'd normally have in a first 11. So to beat Sri Lanka without having a full strength side is pretty good going for Scotland. Unfortunately, the second game in the series didn't quite go as well, and they lost that quite considerably.
They did finally get that victory against a full member, though, in last couple of days, where they defeated Zimbabwe, scoring 315 again. Kurtzer scoring runs in the first innings, and Zimbabwe failing to chase it down, being bowled out for 272, or was again Duckworth Lewis affected?
A little bit of controversy in this match. At one point, Malcolm Waller was looking on for a century. He'd scored 92 from 62 balls, and he was caught by Chris Saul on the boundary. However, replays would suggest that he perhaps had his foot on the rope when he took the catch, which surely won't please Zimbabwe, because they had the same thing happen to them against Ireland in the World Cup. People may remember the John Mooney catch on the boundary. So Zimbabwe do seem to have a bit of bad luck when it comes to boundary catches against associates.
The other really interesting tournament that was played last week and it's just concluded was the World Cricket League qualifier for Division 5 in Europe, and the 6 teams involved here: Germany, Sweden, Norway, Austria, Belgium and France. A pretty strong lineup of teams. I think any of them would have fancied themselves as being able to make the qualification. I think in the last qualifier for Europe, where Germany was involved in at this level, we predicted that they'd do very well, and then they did not. But it's good to see in this particular one that they did do very well, and in fact won the tournament with 4 wins and a huge net run rate.
They started, you know, pretty sort of rapidly. They had a big win on the opening day against France, with Madassa Mohamed scoring 102 from 62 balls, and he was in the runs again in the second match. They did have a little bit of a bit of a hiccup along the way, which they lost to Sweden in the penultimate round of matches, which I think had they won that match, they would have secured promotion. It just made that final day a little bit more interesting. We should probably say, Sweden finished second. Germany and Sweden actually came up from Division 2 for this tournament, and then they've finished in the top two of Division 1 as well. So, back-to-back promotions for Germany, and then Sweden not too far behind them. Things are starting to be shaken up a bit in that the second tier of European associate sides. You go back a couple, just probably 2 or 3 years ago, and France would have been walking away with this tournament, and now they're finishing bottom. Austria have climbed ahead of Belgium, Sweden ahead of Norway, Germany ahead of Norway as well, and it's all sort of getting a bit shaken up. And I think we're seeing, in the case of Germany and Sweden, two very well run associate sides, or affiliate sides in the case of Sweden, who have really done a good job with development over the last few years, whereas those other sides have perhaps concentrated too much on the national side at the expense of development.
Yeah, Norway was coming down from Division 5, but they only lost the two matches, but they were both to the two teams that finished ahead of them, and fairly comprehensive losses as well. So they'll certainly be disappointed that they didn't have a better tournament. They did have the leading wicket taker in Waqas Ahmed. 13 wickets, an average of 8.5, but it wasn't enough.
You look at that Norwegian team, though, and it doesn't change that much. There's the odd player who comes in, but it's the same core that they had when they sort of started to do well about 10 years ago. So, again, it's development hasn't been done very as well there as it has in Germany and obviously in Sweden as well.
In other matches, Andrew, Afghanistan has been touring the West Indies. They started with some T20 matches, and they weren't great for Afghanistan the first two games. They lost pretty comprehensively. 6 wickets and 29 runs. The batting just didn't fire. The third match they lost in the final over, but again by 7 wickets. So a 3-0 loss in the T20 matches, but at least improving. And obviously they're playing defending champions of the World T20, so they're not easy games.
Yeah, although they did beat the West Indies during that World 2020 match, World 2020 tournament, so I think they'll be disappointed with a 3-0 defeat. I think they would have been hoping to maybe at least win one of these games. It's just those sort of old sort of Afghan batting frailties that sort of flare up from time to time. That used to be really common, but they sort of started to die out. But we saw that against in the last series they had against Zimbabwe. So it's always a concern with Afghanistan that sometimes the batting just collapses. It's either sort of spectacularly good or spectacularly bad sometimes.
They turned it around in the one-day series, which has concluded now with a 1-1 result. The final match was abandoned after the toss. The first game, though, is the interesting one. Afghanistan made 212 for 6, and then Rashid Khan stamped his authority all over the West Indies innings, and they end up winning that by 63 runs. It was quite an extraordinary performance by him.
Yeah, I've watched the highlights of this of the West Indies innings, and I say highlights, not highlights of the West Indies in this. It's all highlights of Rashid Khan. He's like 7 for 18. It's the fourth best bowling performance in ODI history, and you just watch. He's getting. It's not as if the West Indies batsmen are failing to read them. They read him. They're picking his googly, and just not being able to play it. He is just a brilliant, brilliant bowler, and it's sort of no surprise he got picked up in the IPL. It's a shame he can't play county cricket. I'd love to see him playing county cricket, getting bowling on some English pitches against English batsmen who are terrible against leg spin. That'd be great. He's just something else. He's an amazing player, and let's hope he continues to play for Afghanistan for a number of years.
And even in the second match, Afghanistan's batting failed completely. Only Gubuddin Naib scored anything of note. Had two pretty good matches, actually. He scored a 50 in this one, but they only made 135. But even in this Mad Tureshi Khan still took 3 for 26, and West Indies was 6 wickets down in what really should have been a pretty straightforward chase. He induced panic in them just from his ability and the fact that they're really not sure how to play him.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the his stats across the two matches. You know, he took 10 wickets for just 44 runs at 2.35 and over. You know, it's not often you see leg spinners dominate like that in limited overs cricket. You can't really use enough superlatives about him. He's just a fantastic player, and what more can we say?
Well, I will say, at risk of turning this into a Rashid Khan fan podcast, he did also, we haven't mentioned his performances in the IPL, which concluded between our last recording and now, but even there, he was amongst the best bowlers in the world playing in Indian pitches. There were, within 2 or 3 matches, captains are talking about how they needed to play him out in order to make sure that he didn't run through them. He took 70 wickets in the tournament at 22. He wasn't the highest wicket taker in the tournament, but no one with more wickets had a better economy rate, which was 6.62 for the tournament. I think it was 10th on the list, but there's a couple of bowlers who only bowled 3 overs in there. It's quite an amazing tournament from someone who's still incredibly young, when you think about it, playing in what is basically the best league in the world.
I think he's made himself a long career. He's going to be playing in a lot of professional leagues around the world. And again, it's a shame that he can't play in England. Although if Afghanistan do get full membership, that would change. You look at his career bowling average in one day internationals, and he is currently top of the list of bowlers who have bowled over 1,000 balls. You know, he's quite a bit ahead of the second player in second place, which is Joel Garner, one of the best players ever to play. You know, his career bowling average is 14.74. Garner's is 18.84. He's a pretty special player, and he's done a lot in such a short time, and hopefully he can keep up this form.
It could be noted too, he hasn't actually played that many matches against associates in that. Most of the games have been, maybe they've been against Zimbabwe, who aren't strong obviously, but they're not, he hasn't been rolling through, you know, Namibias and Kenyas. He's just actually had to play Ireland, Zimbabwe and West Indies and teams like that.
He doesn't just do it against weaker sides. He does it against a lot of strong sides as well.
Speaking of players that will have long careers, they're good to note that Jersey's Jonty Jenner, a player who's been on the associate screens for a fair while now, has made his first class debut for Sussex against the Brigade and scored 68. He put on 172 in that match with Delray Rawlins from Bermuda, so Sussex have found a little tap of lower level associate cricketers, which is good to see for associate cricket, as long as hopefully they'll continue to play for their nations.
That's always the big if, especially with your Jenner in the case. He's from the British Isles, so he's relatively easy for him to end up qualifying for England. I think I first died predicting him for big things on this podcast for nearly 4 years ago now. I think I first saw him play about 5 years ago in an under-15 match when he was 14, and he played for the under-19s and the senior side when he was just 15. You know, you do see young players playing for the Channel Island sides a lot because, you know, it's a small player pool, but, you know, Jenner's not being picked just to make up the numbers. He's one of the best players in Jersey, you know, probably the best player in Jersey at the moment. And, you know, he's obviously, you know, it's a tour game against South Africa A, so, you know, Sussex are never going to be playing a full strength side, but that they actually consider him capable of playing in this game he's still only 19. He's obviously, they see him as a very promising prospect for the future.
In other news, Andrew, it's good to note that from the executive meeting of the Federation of International Cricketers Associations, FICA, that they've established or have noted the establishment of a Scottish Cricketers Association, and that FICA's confirmed that they're committed to assisting players from associate countries form their own associations. So some of these associate issues, making sure that associate cricketers have a voice in the cricketers' side, and that voice will come through. And FICA's been very strongly supportive of expansion of cricket, so having the associate players have their own associations and that voice is good news.
It certainly is. It'd be interesting to see what happens with if associate players do start unionising and perhaps being able to start demanding more things. So it, obviously it's still early days. So we'll just keep an eye on this and see where this goes.
In Afghanistan news, there was a couple of things of note. One was that they cancelled the tour of Ireland in order to support their domestic tournament, I think a T20, but also that they've reduced ties with Pakistan, potentially cut off completely as a result of the recent terrorism attack, which hopefully can be re-established at some point, because they've been a very useful and long-running association with Pakistan, but obviously a lot of politics involved as well.
Yeah, so it's sort of always a little bit unfortunate when you see politics get involved with cricket. You know, and this came just after they'd announced the sort of memorandum of understanding where Pakistan were going to supply more support to Afghanistan. I think Afghanistan were planning on a tour of Pakistan as well. And then all of a sudden that sort of agreement collapsed in a couple of days. You can sort of understand why that would be the case, but still very unfortunate.
And finally, there'll be an ICC meeting very soon. The Cricket Committee has already, as usual, stated their support for changes to structure of cricket. But the important one with the executives is coming up. It's very unclear what will happen with this. The structure may have changed again since the previous one. And India has been rattling their sabres about money, and in fact about the governance changes, which are in fact obviously really important as well. So it'll be an interesting meeting when it occurs.
Yeah, we'll start seeing what have been done in various back rooms and see what the final sort of outcome is. It's certainly the most eagerly anticipated ICC meeting in some time, if ICC meetings can ever be eagerly anticipated.
And with that, that's it. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Russ.